This is an ABC podcast.
You could see recovery in the surrounding trees and vegetation, but the recovery within people themselves took longer. And especially with COVID, what we really wanted was to get together and give each other a hug.
Regional communities often come together in the wake of a tragedy, but COVID has made that hard for bushfire and flood survivors in New South Wales. We'll hear from communities who feel they've been kicked while they are already down. And behind WA's closed border, plenty of locals have taken up the call to wander out yonder, but it's meant the flying doctors have been kept busy.
When you consider the logistics of it, were it not for the flying doctor, you would have done 1,300 kilometres in an ambulance, which was just an impossibility.
I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide. Firstly tonight, the Senate inquiry into the destruction of Juukan Gorge caves by Rio Tinto has travelled to the Pilbara to meet with traditional owners and to see the site firsthand. Committee Chair Warren Ench promised traditional owner group the PKKP that the inquiry's final report would not be released until the committee could travel to the Pilbara. This was complicated by WA's hard border, but even with the recent announcement on the easing of border restrictions, the group was able to receive an exemption to travel. Today, the committee commenced hearings in the Pilbara. Here's Chair Warren Ench.
We're here today. We made a commitment to the PKKP people much earlier in the piece that we would not complete this inquiry or this element of the inquiry, because we have to look at right across all of Australia in relation to cultural heritage protection. But given the destruction of the Juukan caves and the Section 18, we prioritised to do this one first. But we just couldn't do this and couldn't finalise it until we actually come here ourselves.
PKKP Chair John Ashburton told Mark Bennett that today is very significant.
It's a very important day for my people today to pass on important statements to the Senator today. It's very important for us to, in order to protect our 46,000-year-old site. Families was deeply saddened. They presented their pain, their anger, and the fear of the outcomes, the further outcomes of the future. So it's the heritage legislation that needs, that's what we want to change and what we want to see to change and make it happen for everybody.
And what about improving communications with the mining companies? Because there seems to, in previous hearings, that's really come across, there's been a breakdown between head office and local people and your people.
Yeah, there is a breakdown in the office, especially with engaging back with the Rio again. It's going to take a while for us to repair that partnership again.
Tomorrow you're taking the senators out to actually have a look at the site. Yep. What are you hoping that will achieve?
So we are taking the senators out tomorrow. We are going to show them the devastation of what has occurred in early this year on May the 20th. Going to go by stages to make them aware that what we had to do to make them aware of the site, but now it's been devastated, destroyed by the Rio. A 46,000-year-old site needs to be protected. It doesn't matter which site it is on in any of places in Australia. All these sites need to be protected.
That's PKKP Chair John Ashburton. The hearing also took evidence from other Aboriginal and traditional owner groups, such as the Murujuga Aboriginal Corporation from the Karratha area. Their CEO, Peter Jeffries, raised the fear of repercussions that traditional owners have when they speak out against mining companies who they are working with.
There is a real fear, genuine fear, that there will be financial repercussions for MAC if I do so. As I said before, the decision for me to come here today is a difficult one, because despite our responsibility to manage Murujuga, our ability to do so is intrinsically linked to the internal approval processes of our proponents. And we have funding applications in process that may become stalled or as a result of what I say here today. It is a single small example of the power that mining companies wield over Aboriginal corporations right across this country. Without breaching any laws, agreements or conditions of their license to operate, mining companies have enormous silent influence over what we do, say and commit to.
That's Murujuga Aboriginal Corporation CEO Peter Jeffries addressing the parliamentary Senate inquiry. And the Senate inquiry will visit the Juukan Gorge site tomorrow, and a report is expected in December.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
Bushfires, smoke haze, floods and a global health pandemic. Those still recovering from the devastating start of the year feel like COVID-19 has kicked them while they are already down. Canberra reporter Isaac Nuruzi caught up with a farmer in Araluen who's rebuilding his home, and residents in Nelligen who are rebuilding their community spirit.
It wasn't bushfires that took out Mick Mason's farm in Araluen, but a flood that came shortly after.
It was the floods, really. The floods sort of, the first ones after the fire, they came down so hard. It was running down the hill about a foot high. And then, coincidentally, that actually knocked a lot of the foundations away from half the house. So we've been rebuilding the house.
Mick and his partner also lost a dog in the flood and have spent the last 8 months rebuilding the property. They've been forced to live outdoors ever since.
What's it been like living outdoors for the last 8 months?
Oh, you know, you've got to love camping to do it. We've got the outside kitchen here while we've rebuilt the one inside. You know, outside shower, outside toilet. Yeah, it's been interesting, but, oh, yeah, getting into the shower at 0 degrees is yeah, you know you're alive, that's for sure. You definitely know you're alive.
They've also been hit hard by the pandemic. They use their land for adjustment and to train horses, but a lot of the stock comes from Victoria. Farmers there are herding too, so sending stock to Araluen just isn't feasible for anyone involved.
Probably about 30% of our horses.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it just risk. Like, we're trying real hard not to take too many risks now.
Yeah.
Just can't wait for it all to
be done.
Be done, get back up and running, get back to sort of semi-normality.
That's where part of the like little bits of depression come from, I reckon. It's just sort of things being taken away from you without, you know, you being able to do anything about it.
Yeah. I guess that's the last thing that you thought would happen, you know, after the fires and the floods and all that. And next
well, it
thing
was, yeah.
Pandemic.
We joked about it. We said, oh, the bubonic plague's coming next.
And yeah.
Yeah, kind of did.
Further down the New South Wales south coast, in the town of Nelligen, just outside Batemans Bay, COVID has taken its toll on residents. In times of turmoil, small communities come together, but health restrictions have stopped that.
COVID, of course, has affected things. As a community, we haven't been able to get together.
It took quite a while to deal with it, process it, and feel as though that you were getting on top of it. It took quite a while. You could see recovery in the surrounding trees and vegetation, but the recovery within people themselves took longer. And especially with COVID, what we really wanted was to get together and give each other a hug and provide support, and COVID interfered with all that.
As restrictions ease, so too does some of the burden these residents have been holding on to. But with another summer approaching, many are on edge.
We're so fortunate to have had the rain.
Yeah.
But a lot of the things that were a problem before are still a problem.
Yeah.
And with the rain, you get new growth. And what do we do about managing the land and the growth?
Yeah.
And making sure that the fires we had, we just don't have again.
I think there's still a deal of anxiety. September, the RFS had a barbecue down here for the beam prepared. And just about everyone who came over for a snack wanted to talk about their fire experiences.
They just hope that life will go back to something that resembles normal soon.
Isaac Nuruzi with that report. And you heard from Araluen farmer Mick Mason and Nelligen residents Glenda Blanche, Faye Alf and Rita Paul.
ABC Australia Wide.
Country people can't be discriminated against. Not in Tumut.
They were homesick, you know, poor little lumps.
A flood is a flood and a fire is a fire and a drought is a drought.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
And you're with me, Alex Hyman. Great to have your company. I'm in for Sinead Mangan. A boom in local travellers exploring WA while interstate and international travel has been restricted has been great for the state's local tourism operators and small businesses. But it appears to have contributed to a record increase in medical transfers by the Royal Flying Doctor Service. In July, the RFDS experienced its busiest month ever, busiest since it first started moving patients by air in 1935. But as Cecile O'Connor reports, by the next month, that record had already been broken.
Perth couple Tom and Mary Fleming were on their first road trip north earlier this month when a fall in Exmouth brought the holiday to a halt.
As the afternoon grew on, it became worse and worse, to the extent that I was lying on the bed, couldn't move, and if I did move, it was an extremely painful exercise.
Tom, who's 70, suffered a broken hip. As the pain worsened, he went to hospital and was then transferred to Perth for surgery.
When you consider the logistics of it, were it not for the flying doctor, you would have done 1,300 kilometres in an ambulance, which was just an impossibility, absolute impossibility. So there's no way it could have been done other than with the flying doctor service.
He's one of more than 3,300 patients who've been transferred by the Air Medical Service in WA since July, about 350 more than the same time last year. Dr. Andy Thalander is a senior doctor with the RFDS in Jandakot.
Oh, it's been phenomenal. It's been 27% as a numerical value, as a net increase, but on the ground it feels quite a lot larger than that.
The number of air transfers has been increasing for the RFDS every year, and with West Australians restricted from travelling beyond state borders, the service anticipated there'd be more, but the size of the increase has caught them by surprise.
We certainly felt in the very early parts of the post-lockdown period that this would happen, but what's incredible and unbelievable is the fact that this has continued, and not even just continued, but the record numbers that seem to be growing.
July was the busiest month since the service started in 1935, with 844 transfers. But that record was quickly surpassed with 860 passengers in August and 896 in September, about a 27% increase on last year.
Certainly, when you look at a net increase, it's a multifactorial event, and the border closure and local travel increases is a part of our increased workload, but it certainly would be misleading to say that that's the only factor involved, but certainly probably the most easily identifiable, yes.
Trauma, heart attacks and strokes are the most common emergencies.
It tends to be the same breakdown of patients, so medical patients, obstetric patients, trauma, paediatric. We are seeing a similar sort of case mix, so there's not any one particular type of presentation that is predominant over the others, but we're just seeing larger numbers of these typical cases.
He says grants and fundraising mean the RFDS is equipped to cope with the extra demand. Tom Fleming says he is extremely grateful for the Royal Flying Doctor, which was able to get him to specialist orthopaedic care so quickly.
When you guys came along and asked me would I be interested in doing this interview, there is no way that I would refuse it, none whatsoever, because my considered opinion is that without that service, I would be still up in Exmouth and in pain and grief and everything else like that.
It is great work that they do. Cecile O'Connor with that report into just how busy it's been for the Royal Flying Doctor Service in WA recently.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
It's a species that I have been fighting for.
Growing up in the bush is such a special thing.
So when the rain does come, we've got a few numbers.
What if it never comes?
Put a feather in your cap.
ABC Radio.
It's 20 years since Australia was declared free of polio, an important milestone because for Australians born before the 1960s, this highly infectious disease was a real and frightening possibility. Vaccination has brought the disease under control, but there's concern that people who've been touched by polio aren't getting the support they need as they age. Our reporter Emily Doak in Wagga Wagga has been looking into the story.
Well, I know I can't move any of my joints from my knee down, but I've never had the movement of the joints from my knee down anyway, so you don't miss it.
Doug Waite was just 8 months old when he contracted polio and doesn't remember life without its debilitating impacts. Polio is a viral disease that attacks the nervous system. It mainly affects children and can cause paralysis and death. Epidemics in the 1930s and 1950s crippled tens of thousands of Australian children, and Doug's story is similar to many of them.
Oh, geez, I remember getting carted around the children's hospital at Camperdown, the old children's hospital, and they'd put you in there and they'd make you stand on a wooden ramp to try and stretch the back of your muscles. And when I was about, 11... I went into hospital for about probably 2 months and I had what they call a triple arthrodesis, which is a big operation in both legs. And then they sort of cut the muscles and I guess fuse your ankles to keep them roughly at a right angle, even though mine dropped down a bit. But yeah, I had the calipers, the full bit. And I know even my dad, he knew some friends that were bootmakers and they made me a little pair of football boots and everything, and that was without the calipers, but everything had to be specially made.
20 years on from the declaration that Australia was free from this highly infectious disease, many people are still living with the impacts, and not just those like Doug. Alan Cameron from Polio Australia says decades on, many people suffer post-polio syndrome.
Sometimes that doesn't occur until 40 or 50 years after they've had polio. And people who might otherwise appear perfectly well from the time they had polio until now find that they are becoming increasingly disabled. It's a rather insidious component of what polio does.
Because many of these people are over the age of 65, they're not eligible for the National Disability Insurance Scheme. And Polio Australia says funding through aged care packages isn't enough.
They can access aged care, but the aged care packages don't adequately cover things like wheelchairs and prosthesis and the like, which is often the requirement these people have. There is some light at the end of the tunnel, in fact, I might say. Council assisting the Royal Commission into Disabilities has put a interim recommendation that this form of discrimination be taken out and people within NDIS or aged care will be treated equally. But there's a fair way between that being declared a possibility and it being, in fact, legislated.
Alan Cameron from Polio Australia. The introduction of vaccines in the 1960s brought polio under control in Australia, and today they're included in the routine child immunisation schedule. Paediatric infectious disease specialist Dr. Phil Britton from the Children's Hospital at Westmead in Sydney says we have a good track record with more than 95% of Australian children getting the jab.
Australia's got rid of polio through vaccination and needs to maintain vaccination because there is still polio in the world. And one of the catch cries in this space is that polio anywhere is a risk for polio everywhere. And there's no treatments for the polio virus. All we have is supportive care if somebody gets polio, and so prevention's always going to be better than treatment and cure.
Back in Wagga Wagga, Doug Waite says the 20-year anniversary is a milestone, but he's not let polio define him.
All the school councils were saying, now, what do you want to do? I said, I want to do something like in the motor trade, panel beating or something. No, you'd be better off in the bank where you just stand behind the... I said, no, I'm not going to do that. Anyway, so I got an apprenticeship with NRMA in Sydney as a panel beater, and then eventually TAFE teaching. I've had not a bad life.
Emily Doak with that story. A cultural approach to mental health challenges in WA's outback appears to be paying dividends. An annual camp led by women is helping them to find new ways to improve mental health. This year, 70 service providers and women from the Leonora community travelled to Sir Samuel in WA's Goldfields region for the camp. Madison Snow has the story.
In the middle of Western Australia's outback, at an abandoned town site, something a little different is happening. 70 women have gathered for a four-day camp to highlight the importance of community and to take an Indigenous approach to tackling mental health.
Being out here, the mindset changes and spiritually it's good, so it's important that we come out on country instead of having talks in the four walls of a building.
That's Colleen Berry. She organised the Nunyugu Women's Camp, which brings service providers in law, health, mental health and well-being together with the community. The intention is to break down barriers between service providers and women who need their help.
When we have camps like this, the service providers can come out on country, sit around, and the community can get to know them on a different side. They can mingle, they can talk about any issues they want, and it's private. They need to talk to a counsellor, sit under a lovely shady tree instead of going into an office where they get shamed to do that.
Miss Berry founded Nunyugu in 2016.
Noongar meaning woman. Gu is belonging to Leonora, a women's group for Leonora community. It was designed to bring all the ladies together in the community to enjoy sewing, any other arts and crafts, organise camps, just to bring all the ladies together in a safe place.
Miss Berry is a proud Wongatha woman who is passionate about supporting her community. Through Nunyugu meetings in town, she started noticing a need for extra support, so she stepped up.
Mental health has become something really big in our communities with our young people, you know, the misuse of drugs and other stuff. There's a lot of families now that are having to deal with the issues they face with these young people, and it's hard, so the more knowledge they have of it, it's better for them to cope.
The camp is for all the women of Leonora, and while the focus is on mental health and wellness, Miss Berry hopes attendees will take away more.
As they get to experience our culture, but being out here, it's amazing. So I'm passionate about being on my country. Where I look around, I see my old people and what they've done, you know, my family. It's beautiful, and it brings back all those memories, you know, of my family telling me stories about the knowledge that I gained from here, from my mom, nanas, all the people I love.
At the camp during the day, women sit together under shady marquees to take part in activities like worry doll making, bush medicine, massage and facials. Breakfast, lunch and dinner is put on by a local mining company, but some traditional foods are cooked too, including kangaroo tail and goanna. By night you'll find people yarning around campfires, opening up about their lives and sometimes their pain.
Most of us, you know, we have problems, but we are too scared to talk about it. And it's really good to see what service providers have got to offer and most of the people sharing their stories.
That's Vicky Abdullah, a traditional owner from the area. She also attended the camp. She says the freedom of being on country puts the women at ease.
A lot of people feel it's really good being sort of out on country, and some people don't like speaking in a four walls sort of thing, you know, in offices or, you know, hospitals or something. But it's really good to be sitting and talking to people out on country because you feel so relaxed.
On day two of the camp, each service provider stood up to talk about what they do.
So I work the Goldfields Mental Health Portal, which is connected to the centre care.
Some shared personal stories, explaining what led them to work or volunteer in their respective fields.
They're very strong ladies. They were touched by some of the stories that came out and was emotional. It's good. They can cry if they want to, you know, and no one's going to judge them. This is what having a camp is about. Cry and let your emotions out. And it's wonderful you've got everybody that'll support you.
So amazing to hear a lot of stories stepping up to do their own thing, you know. So powerful. Every woman have a different sort of issue behind closed door. And it's really nice to share a lot of stuff when you're out here in the bush talking, and don't be ashamed. I find that most people feel ashamed to talk.
For Miss Abdullah, the benefits of using a cultural approach to mental health are clear.
I think I feel a lot better, yeah. I'd like to see more camps and more people to come and express their feelings sometime and have a bit of yarn with people, you know, if you got problems. And I think my first step is try and get help, what I've been going through, yeah. If you need, want that help, yeah, gotta stick to it.
Madison Snow with that story. And thanks so much for your company. That's the program. I'm Alex Hyman. Have a great evening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.